Hello and welcome. My name is Patrick Campbell, and I will be your host for this episode of The Endocrine Outlook, brought to you by EndocrinologyNetwork.com. In this episode, you'll check out an interview featured in MJH's Medical World News from February 14th. In the interview, I speak with Dr. Ariana Chow, an associate professor of nursing at Penn Nursing, author of a recent study published in the Journal of Clinical Investigation titled Dietary Interventions for Obesity, Clinical and Mechanistic Findings. Dr. Chow and I discuss her recent study, its findings, and then go a little bit deeper into dietary science and explore the role of nutrition in obesity management. Without further ado, here is my conversation with Dr. Chow. And the way we usually like to start these interviews is by having our guests give a brief background on who they are and their expertise before we dive into questions. So if you wanted to do that, then we could start right away with questions.
Sure, that sounds great. So thank you so much for having me. My name is Dr. Ariana Chow. I'm an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Nursing. And I'm also the medical director at the Center for Weight and Eating Disorders at the School of Medicine here at UPenn. And my expertise is on behavioral and pharmacological treatments for obesity, as well as for binge eating disorder.
All right, thank you for that. And now the study that we're going to be talking about today is titled Dietary Interventions for Obesity, Clinical and Mechanistic Findings. Now, Dr. Chow, you led this study. Do you want to just take our listeners through a little bit behind the sort of impetus of this study and then what you think the key findings were?
Sure. So this was a narrative review that we did that was really compelled by the fact that a lot of patients who come to see me are very confused about what sort of diet would be best for them. So we know there's all sorts of different diets, low fat, low carb, there's different Atkins diets, intermittent fasting has become very popular. And we wanted to take a look and see what the literature was telling us about whether there's actually any benefits of one particular diet to weight loss. And we took an approach that really was looking at different primary factors. So level of energy restriction is oftentimes manipulated in different studies. So there's a whole body of research looking at whether very low carb diets, so less than 800 calories, might produce better weight losses compared to something that's a little bit higher in calories. There's things that have different macronutrient manipulation. So again, comparing low carb versus low fat. Dietary timing has also become very popular, looking at things like intermittent fasting and whether they offer any advantages to continuous energy restriction. And also dietary intake patterns, so things like the Mediterranean diet or DASH diets. So that's kind of what drove us to kind of look at this whole big body of research studies. And what we essentially found is that there are some short-term differences. So in about at 6 months or so, if you're putting someone on a lower carb diet or lower calorie diet, they'll tend to lose more weight. Same thing with carbohydrates, actually. So if you put someone on a very low carb diet compared to a low fat diet, there tends to be more weight reduction around 6 months or so. However, if you look longer term at 12 months or so, really many people are doing the same, and we didn't find any sort of clear advantage of one type of diet to the other. The most important factor really seems to be how well someone can adhere to a diet. And it's still very unclear about what drives adherence to a particular diet. Interestingly enough, there have actually been some studies that have looked at whether you randomize people to picking a diet based on their preference versus just completely random. And you would think that someone's preference would really drive what sort of diet or their weight loss on a particular diet, but actually those studies have found that there's no difference. So there's still a lot of work to be done, I think, in the area, but in general, I think it should be reassuring for some clinicians that there's a whole wide range of diets that people could follow to lose weight.
All right, and now let me ask you before we dive sort of into discussions about specific diets and the trends that we're seeing in nutrition. When clinicians who aren't specialists in nutrition and sort of dietary science go and try to find research, there's obviously mountains of data that come out related to nutrition, and a lot of people sort of pick and choose the ones they want to read according to what they believe. What would you tell clinicians to look for specifically when reading about new diet or nutrition research? Because obviously conducting a randomized clinical trial of people specifically adhering to a specific diet is hard to do, as you mentioned, with adherence issues. Mm-hmm. What do you look for in terms of quality research?
Sure. So I think you've hit on one of the points already, that looking at observational studies versus interventional randomized controlled trials are different. So I think sometimes there'll be some splashy news articles that are highlighting some results from observational studies, which are very important, but again, they're just observations. And I think a good example of this has to do with things like some findings about genetics and the influences on weight loss, possibly. But there have been randomized controlled trials randomizing people with different genetic codes to different types of diets based on that. And they've shown that really there's no weight loss in a random difference in weight loss for a randomized controlled trial. So I think that's important to remember if it's an observational study versus a randomized clinical trial. The randomized clinical trial is likely going to be the stronger design. Also looking at things like population. So if it's very similar to the population of patients that you see in clinic, that's obviously a good match. The dose is really important as well. So again, looking at things like adherence and how well people are able to stay on the diet and how high the attrition rate is. Duration is also super important as well. We're looking for longer term solutions. So typically the longer the study, the more impactful for clinical practice, I would say.
All right, and now just sort of transitioning here a little bit, where do you think diet and nutrition fit into risk factor management? Obviously, obesity is a huge issue, diabetes as well, cardiovascular disease, and the one thing that is listed in every FDA label is that most of the agents are adjuncts to proper exercise and diet. Yeah. How much are we falling short on emphasizing that to patients? And just how important is diet and nutrition when we're talking about risk factor management?
Yeah, so I think it's really, really important. So for some of the medications, we know that if people are put on a medication, oftentimes they need to have these other sorts of lifestyle modification factors going on to control the external environment as well. The medication often works on some different physiological and internal systems, but really kind of being able to control what they're eating is really important as well in terms of external factors. I think it's also really important to consider too that there's a lot of effective behavioral weight loss programs that have been shown to have decreases in things like insulin resistance and glucose tolerance, as well as hypertension. Patients are able to stop their medications oftentimes if they're able to achieve weight losses with certain dietary programs.
All right, thank you for that. And now when you're discussing nutrition or diet with a patient or a non-clinician, what are the most important aspects that you stress about a diet?
Sure. So I personally think that a lot of the behavioral components are really important and oftentimes underemphasized. So making sure that people are able to choose a diet that they are able to stick to in the long term, again, so that adherence factor that they're going to like and enjoy is also really important as well. Things like emphasizing, you know, self-monitoring is a behavioral strategy, as well as things like goal setting, increasing other activities that also influence nutrition. So things like their sleep and their stress are also really important as well.
Now, let me ask you, in the COVID era that we seem to find ourselves in, with remote patient monitoring really taking hold and serving a really useful role, has it become more difficult, you think, for patients to manage their diets and stick to their diets during this sort of work from home or quarantine periods, or has it become easier?
I think it's become easier for some, harder for others. So I think this is, again, a lot of the heterogeneity that we see in patients too. So for my patients who might have had a lot of struggles with eating out, the restaurant closures kind of have eliminated some of that. Same thing with patients who might have been our social drinkers, and we know that alcohol tends to lead to some more disinhibited types of eating behaviors. That has been helpful for them. Others, people are at home and they're struggling with like grazing and kind of a lack of structure that used to be imposed by the workday when they would travel to the office and then, you know, come home. So kind of that constant access to the refrigerator or kitchen can be challenging for some as well.
All right, and now I just had another question related to sort of not specifically this study that you just performed, but research in general. You had mentioned sort of some studies like to make a big splash in the headline when they're talking about diet or nutrition. And we often do see a lot of those studies have funding sources from within an industry. I know oftentimes whenever we see a story about peanuts being good for the heart, it's usually funded by some sort of peanut group. Does that ever make research difficult for you, or make you feel like these studies have to produce some sort of significant results, just given the way that a lot of the research in your space likes to really make a bang with the results?
I think it depends. You know, it's hard to say that there is necessarily one strict answer to that. I think some of the trials are done really rigorously and have really, you know, high bars in terms of their comparison group. So that oftentimes can lead to a significant difference or not based on what sort of control group you're using. So I think that that can be one factor in it. But I wouldn't say necessarily in general, if something's funded by a particular industry, that it necessarily makes it any lesser in terms of science. It kind of depends on the rigor of the actual study.
All right, and now, as we move forward and we learn more and more about nutrition, what do you think are some of the most important topics that need to be addressed going forward in, let's just say, the next 2-3 years?
Yeah, I think the variability in outcomes that we see with diets is really one of the top things. So we know that oftentimes some patients do so well on a particular dietary plan, but others will end up gaining weight at the end. So I think figuring out that is so important. I think we've also recognized too that we can have patients lose weight using a particular regimen, you know, pretty reliably, but right around 6 months or so, there tends to be this weight regain. So I think figuring that out and figuring really long-term solutions to help people with weight loss maintenance is really critical as well.
All right, and now I just have to ask you, just because they get compared so often now, we've seen a lot of talk about the DASH versus a Mediterranean diet. And obviously, this sort of depends, as you mentioned, on patient preference. And then we've also seen a little bit more research recently into sort of this low-fat vegan diet. What do you think are some of the more common aspects that these diets should share? Obviously, most people branch somewhere between the three, or if they're trying to achieve that healthy balance, what are some of the more important components you think should definitely be included in the diet?
Yeah, so I think increasing fruits and vegetables is sort of a number one that's kind of consistent against all of these programs, right? And as well as, you know, reducing added sugars, reducing sodium where possible, reducing processed foods. I think that's kind of just general tips that you can give to all patients that are common across most of these programs.
And then just one of my final questions for you. We've seen a lot of talk sort of about the impact that an educational intervention can have on these programs or can have on patients. Mm-hmm. I was just curious what your thoughts on that were and what you think the most efficient way to engage patients on a conversation about diet is.
Yeah. So I think there are a number of different factors. I think meeting the patient where they are is really important. So kind of starting with changes that the patient feels like they want to make and that they can change are, so those small wins are so important just to get some good momentum to make these harder changes. So oftentimes I'll start with my patients with changes that they bring to the table that they see really as their critical issues, instead of imposing my own thoughts into what I feel like they should change first. Also making sure things are sort of realistic is really important as well. I'm not sure if I addressed the whole question.
No, that was a good answer. Now just moving on, one final question for you. One of the things that we've seen a lot of is sort of distance and distance to fast food proximities, or sort of the impact of a sugar tax. I know we've seen a lot coming out of Philadelphia specifically with the sugar tax. What do you think the role of sort of these government programs play is when we're trying to reform societal sort of views of obesity and diet? And
yeah,
nutrition?
I think they're so important because we know, and I hear this in clinic sometimes too, that patients might not just have the access to things. They might live in food deserts and at the same time be in a food swamp where there's a lot of convenience stores that don't necessarily have the most healthy foods. And I try to provide them some education about some different alternatives that they could have. But I think addressing those other issues are really, really important. I think the research will be really interesting that comes out, especially in Philadelphia, looking at the soda tax and some more research and longer term outcomes in terms of whether that, you know, obviously reduces sugar sweetened beverage consumption, but other things like whether people are compensating for other foods and some unintended consequences that might occur with those sorts of taxes.
Okay, and now are there, obviously the hope would be that, most clinicians would be well-versed enough to be able to give their patients guidance on where to go or sort of how to mold their diet. But what clinicians do you think should be most well-versed? Obviously, cardiologists, advanced care practitioners in cardiology, those who care for diabetes patients come to mind. What do you think should be the specialists that are 110% ready to talk to their patients about diet? Yeah.
Well, I think a lot, like almost all providers should be versed in some sort. I think some will likely do screening and then referral, but they'll have to have, you know, bring up some initial conversations. There's even been some interventions looking at like dentists and screening, since there can be more dental caries in people who are eating high sugar foods. So I think all providers should have some level of being able to address weight and obesity without having it be stigmatizing for the patient, which can create a lot of shame and guilt. And then that patient might not be seeking out healthcare and also just might have a lot of internalized weight bias from those experiences. So we want to make sure that providers are able to sort of address it, bring it up, but then also know the appropriate referral strategies that are available. I think primary care can be a good place to address weight. However, we also know that there needs to be some level of intensity of behavioral counseling that might be hard to achieve in a busy primary care practice. So kind of working on the realities of that can be challenging. I think, endocrinologists are really in a prime spot to be able to help discuss weight management, as well as coordinate things like pharmacotherapy that might be used as an adjunct to some behavioral weight loss strategies as well.
All right, that was really about it on my questions. Was there anything you wanted to add sort of about the realm of diet and nutrition or about your study that we didn't get to touch on?
I don't think so. Yeah, covered. Like, those are great questions. I think all really relevant to the time and to the state of the science as well. It's kind of fun. A lot of people I feel like don't ask about necessarily like the science aspect of it. So I think that's really a great angle.
Awesome. Thank you very much. That was it on my questions. Thanks for taking the time to speak with me today. I appreciate it.
Oh, you're so welcome. Thanks for the invitation. I appreciate it.
That's it for this episode of the Endocrine Outlook. Thank you again to Dr. Chow for taking part in that interview. And thank you for listening. For the latest in endocrinology news, be sure to head to endocrinologynetwork.com and subscribe to our free e-newsletters.